And I do believe that you probably did not get Uncle Peckerhead in Canada because you have health care there. And in return, we get Uncle Peckerhead.
It's an even trade-off. Welcome to the Dead Harvey Podcast. This is the podcast for both indie horror filmmakers and fans. And our goal here is to light the path for indie horror filmmakers and shine a light on indie horror films themselves. We want to find audiences for your films. That really is the goal. We are not going to be technical about the process of filmmaking. We're going to leave that for others. This is about building a community, building audiences, and figuring things out, really getting to know the stories behind the stories. And ultimately, we want to work with filmmakers, producers, and help them find audiences, help these films be successful, and really build an audience around these things. So what would be best is to reach out to us, deadharvey.com. Subscribe, follow, join the team, shoot us an email. We really want to work with you guys. We want to build audiences and figure these things out. So I am Ted Stanford. This is Brad Paulson. And today we're going to talk about the original launch of Dead Harvey when it was a blog. And our first post was in September of 2007. And we kept going for about 5 years until 2013. And now 7 years later, have decided to relaunch as a podcast. So we want to talk a bit about what we learned and what's changed. But before we get to that, Brad is going to tell you about our pick of the week. And we're very excited about this one.
Okay, excellent. Well, this is the new instant classic Uncle Peckerhead. So this was a movie that I saw the name Uncle Peckerhead, and I don't know if it's my juvenile sense of humor or whatnot, but I just started laughing. And then I saw that it had a horror background behind it, blood splatters and all like the classic staples of the horror genre. I was like, I got to watch this movie. I mean, it might be terrible, but I still have to watch just for the name alone. So we were sort of talking about earlier, how much of a factor do you think does a name like that play into somebody watching it? Just for maybe like shits and giggles, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, full disclosure, I have not seen Uncle Peckerhead. And it's not because I didn't want to see it. I did a search on my typical platforms and actually couldn't find it. But it is out there. But it is true. And it actually goes with everything. There are different components that people don't really think about. It's like your cover art, the title, how you describe it, you know, all the little things. Because if you think about it from a different perspective, and you think about, like, I'm just an audience guy, I'm just a user, I'm half drunk sitting on the couch, I'm looking for a movie to watch, and I'm scrolling through stuff, what's going to catch my attention? And it is true that, like, a good film title, if I'm in the mood for something like that, is going to stand out. And Uncle Peckerhead, it's an attention grabber. I don't disagree with having over the top titles that are going to grab attention.
Well, and I'm going to at least give it probably like 10, 20 minutes. If I can't watch any more of it, I'll just tune out, but it's going to grab my attention enough to at least give it 10 courtesy minutes, 10 to 20 courtesy minutes. And I do believe that you probably did not get Uncle Peckerhead in Canada because you have health care there. And in return, we get Uncle Peckerhead.
Even trade-off. Yes. It's an even trend. But we were also talking about before, it's about licensing, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all these different platforms out there. Like, we're up here, we have Crave and Super Channel and a bunch of other stuff, which you guys don't have. And when a sales agent is selling a project, especially an indie project, where they're taking any dollar they could possibly get, they'll sell off little chunks for, like, whatever. It's like, oh, I got to pay $10,000 or $5,000 for the rights for Canada. And it's some random platform that isn't in the States. So what happens is if Prime gets it, then they look at the contract and they're like, oh, we don't actually have the rights in Canada. Then they block it out. That's why you get these countries. It's the same way as like how pre-sales used to work, which I think they still do pre-sales, but they'd sell off different territories, and when someone lands the big contract, they'll look at it and be like, oh, can't broadcast it in Canada, can't broadcast it in France, can't, you know, and it's a contract thing. So it was funny that you were like, hey, watch Uncle Peckerhead, and I actually searched around and for the life of me couldn't find it anywhere. But that's probably the opposite problem, where they're like, sold the rights to the States And they're like, okay, yeah, we want to get it in Canada too. It's like, oh yeah, that's an additional, you know, $5,000. Yeah, 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 yeah. We don't want to spend that. No. Yeah. not worth it.
So Uncle Peckerhead, I thought this was going to be a movie that just exploited this name that would make people laugh and watch on a drunk evening. But there was so much more to it that I pleasantly admit to say. And it's pretty entertaining too. It's about an hour and 40 minutes long. It kept me entertained all the way through.
An hour and 40 minutes? That's actually, that's they went above and beyond there.
They did,
yeah. Like it's totally acceptable to be like 70 minutes right now.
Yeah, so yeah, that's true. So this movie is essentially about, it's kind of like if you take like a road trip movie, and sort of like this band, and it's like this punk rock band, and they're trying to make it. And they leave their jobs behind and everything. They put everything on the line to go on this road trip, to go on a tour. And they don't have enough budget for a van. So they meet this crazy guy whose name is Uncle Peckerhead. And he tells them that he's living in the van and it's his home for him. But he will take them with him. He'll drive them around and he'll be a roadie as long as they buy him some food every now and then. And just sort of like he's their companion as well, too. So then it sort of turns into this kind of Judd Apatow style of like a buddy movie. Where he's with all the companions, and like they start to like grow a friendship for each other, but then they find out that he starts murdering people. He turns into a demon like right around midnight, and he has to take some medication to sort of calm him down and have people watch him. But he just keeps going out of control, and they have to keep forgiving him as they keep going to their places and chasing like the big tour at the end of the show. But there's also a few like trauma throwbacks, but they do have clips from Toxic Avenger 2 in there, so you can see where some of the influences came in. But they actually did a great job writing the script though and casting. So this is a pretty. But
it's not actually a trauma film though, is it?
It's not. No. But they do have a clip from a trauma movie in there, and there are some of the gore moments that are very trauma-esque. But with the over-the-top way that they show the gore in there. But this was a very pleasantly surprising horror hybrid of indie road movie, buddy comedy, and sort of like trauma splatter flick a little bit. So it's definitely worth watching.
It's realistically that, and we'll actually talk about it when we talk about the Dead Harvey and the history of it, when we used to get screener after screener. Half the battle is if you can have a movie that I can sit down with a 12-pack of Bud Light and just be entertained, regardless of the quality of it, be entertained. That's really the battle that you're trying to win here. And this is like, it goes to show like, you know, oh, it's a road trip. We're throwing a bunch of gore. There's a show in it. I mean, I actually thought that I had an idea at one point that what we should be doing with all these indie films is they should have accompanying drinking games. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, so it's like, it's not about like sitting down and, you know, being serious and watching your film here. It's like, go watch it with a bunch of buddies, have a drinking game around it. By the end of it, you know, this is supposed to be entertaining, not as just a film on its own. Like, this is supposed to be a fun experience that you could drink to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds like Uncle Peckerhead, which now I'm going to have to find. I'm just going to have to find. I'm not going to say that I exhausted all my efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to find it. Like, I think I did. I checked Tubi. I checked Prime. Someone needs to invent an app that actually just searches all platforms.
Definitely. Yeah.
Right? Like, if I know that I want to watch Uncle Peckerhead, but I have no idea which platform it's on, I should have one place that I can punch in the name, and then it directs me over. It's like, oh, it's over here. Or oh, hey, that's on this platform. You don't subscribe. Like, there should be an app that does that.
No, I saw Uncle Peckerhead was off of instantwatcher.com. So they put like when they put the new Amazon movies there, and then they put the new Netflix movies as well too. So they also have some stuff that just will like some indie stuff that will like randomly show up on there. And Uncle Peckerhead was one of those. So I get some of my indie recommends movies from that list on there of instantwatcher.com. And then I go to imdb.com. And then it'll show like where you can watch it, like what platform has it, how much it is to rent, and then it will show other viewing options on it. So that's the way that I find stuff. But I haven't found an app that actually does that.
No, this sounds like a terrible process. We're gonna come up with an app that actually aggregates all this to make finding indie shitty movies easy, and all the information about them. So you're gonna log in. It's gonna be a smart TV app too. It's gonna be on your TV. So you can log in on your TV and you're gonna punch in. It's only gonna do this for independent horror. and then you're gonna punch it in. It's gonna find the platform it's on. It's also gonna have the accompanying podcast that we talk about the films. It's all gonna be put in one place. I'm writing it down. It's on our list of things to do. Create app. So that's an entertaining movie. And the funny thing is, what we're going to talk about today, it's a good segue to get into it, is, which is crazy. Like, think about it. 13 years ago, we decided to launch Dead Harvey as a blog. And films like Uncle Peckerhead, at the time when we went through Dead Harvey, I can't count the amount of films that we watched that would be right within that vein. But to step back a little bit, at the time, I can't remember when I left LA, but I had been back home for a while and we'd been going through the screenwriting together. Like, we'd written a bunch of scripts together. And then all of a sudden we kind of missed that networking of being in LA and networking with other indie. You were still there. I was coming down like 3-4 times a year, if I remember, but we were like this networking with different filmmakers. And we said, hey, you know, there's no real place. And keep in mind, it's a different time. 13 years ago, like, blogs were a brand new thing. There was no streaming. I don't even know if Facebook was there. Facebook was probably fairly new at the time.
Facebook was like, I think 2008, I want to say, somewhere around there.
Yeah, it kind of was
MySpace a thing. Phased out right around.
Yeah, it was a thing. Not like social media wasn't really a thing and connecting. So we were like, wouldn't it be cool if we had a blog? Mm-hmm. And we just talked about all these indie horror films and then we could connect with the guys that make them and hell, maybe we'll get some of our own projects made. We'll just kind of create this kind of little community around it. What we didn't expect was pretty quickly, and I'm talking within months, we were inundated with DVDs. We were inundated with people saying, hey, talk about my film. Hey, talk about this, because there really wasn't anything out there that gave people a platform to talk about these things. It was just put it up on Amazon and it was buried at the bottom of Amazon, which I was saying that I used to go every Tuesday, because Tuesday is when the new DVDs were on there. And I would go in there and reverse. I'd go horror, I'd go DVD, horror, and reverse search. So the biggest release would go to the bottom and the shittiest one would go to the top, according to their algorithm.
Yeah.
And then I would look at those top ones and be like, okay, there's the indie ones. Like, they're just buried. But it was interesting how quickly it took off. Like, looking back at our analytics on it, we had over 500,000 unique people visit that site, you know, which by now is not big numbers, but we haven't touched it in almost a decade. And to see that many people kind of went through it was kind of crazy. So today I thought, and by the way, I still think that there's this demand today. Like, I still think, still no one's really, people are talking about it, but no one's touching it in this way of talking it to the nothing filmmaker before they've made it. And when they're trying to promote their film, everyone kind of like, when the one of 1,000 percolates to the top, everyone's going to go talk to that guy and say, hey, tell me about your career path. But no one's diving into the bottom of the pool and saying, hey, tell me about what's going on. Let me help you.
I think there's an appetite for it because Hollywood is completely oversaturated everything with remakes and sequels and everything that's more of like the carbon cutter movie that you've seen the same time a million times over. So back in the 50s, when it used to be Westerns over and over again, almost every movie, now it's like with superhero movies and you just don't see a lot of variety. So, and I love superhero movies, but you don't really see a lot of variety coming out that much anymore, especially for like indie stuff that's more like low budget or more unique. I do believe there's an appetite for it. I've always had an appetite for it. Something that's different, something that's unique, wacky, out there, you know? But it's oftentimes, those are the types of movies that barely get any exposure whatsoever.
Yeah. And it's, if you think about the history of film too, like when you talk about, like, say the 70s, when people were doing experimental films, like when Easy Rider or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Mean Streets and even Star Wars, which really kind of changed everything. Jaws and Star Wars kind of changed stuff. But in the 60s and 70s, there was this, you were allowed to experiment, and it was all kind of one big pot. Like Roger Corman would be playing out of the same pot as like Warner Brothers, right? They're kind of all like, you're getting a theatrical release. There's no other way to do this. But as the risk went higher and higher and higher, like when box office went basically with the rise of the agencies in the 80s and and really big box office movies, they tried to get the risk out of it. So they weren't allowing just a bunch of crazy dudes to go out and make movies anymore. It had to be like tested. And now we're at a point where it's straight up like data runs the movies. Yeah. And so you miss this piece of like just experimental film. And for me, it's always been, I mean, I've loved the fantasy sci-fi genre horror just because there's crazy ideas and crazy shit. And I mean, it started for me at Star Wars, but quickly devolved into like Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and all that type of shit. But you don't see that anymore because it's so formulaic now. And in indie film is really where you have a chance to do crazy shit. And fuck, the stuff that we used to see, like it was interesting to me when you get all these trailers. And what I think we'll talk about next is we'll talk about some of our favorites. We'll talk about two or three of our favorite kind of interviews and people that we met over the course of it. But if you think about it, there was no streaming then. Amazon wasn't streaming anything. It was just straight up books and DVDs. Like it was a matter of you were ordering that DVD. Mm-hmm. YouTube was just kind of a thing. Like it was just kind of like, oh, you could put stuff up there, but it really was dog and cat videos. No one really thought much about what YouTube was, but it did exist. I don't even know if Google owned it at that time. I think it was just kind of its own thing. So it was really this different time where it was like DVDs and people, but you can make a buck off an indie film, right? Like, yeah. Like I remember talking to a bunch of guys who were like, oh no, fuck, all you got to do is get your DVD in a bin at Walmart and we've made our budget back. And that's all gone.
Yeah, right? That's gone. Unfortunately, I was on the Netflix DVD plan. So I had like, so this is before Netflix started doing the streaming. I had like the three DVDs that you could get a month and they would ship them to you. And then you would put them in a little envelope and then ship them back. Sort of like the mail version of Redbox, more or less.
Yeah, it still exists.
They still do have the Netflix DVD plan. Yeah. Yeah.
They still do it. So, I mean, stuff is, I think it's a weird thing to think. Back then, people were, it was almost harder to make a film because you had to actually get, like, right now, people make a film on their phone, right? But back then it was a little harder, but the DVD market was a thing. But you got all these kind of, like, there was so much indie horror out there that you had to siphon through. And it was just such a different time. But what I loved about it was that once people knew that Dead Harvey was going to, we would talk about your film and that people thought about it as a thing. There's only really two things you could do, enter it into a film festival or find guys like us who would talk about it. No one else is going to do anything. And DVD screeners were a thing. And actually, I have no idea if DVD screeners are a thing anymore, but we used to get literally, I think 2, 3, 4, 5 DVDs a week would just show up at our door because they wanted us to review them. And it was awesome. Like I remember having a stack, and then when I would come down to LA and visit you, I would come down with a stack of DVDs and we'd sit there and grab like a pile of Bud Light and cheap whiskey and just sit on the couch and plow through about like as many of these DVDs as we possibly could. Now, I don't know, but you might know better than I do. Are DVD screeners a thing anymore?
I don't know. I think that like people, when they review Oscars, they still get DVD screeners. I don't know. Maybe it's all codes now that they send through.
Well, I would think, because I've gotten a lot of like, say, Vimeo and online stuff where you have to put a password in or it's protected.
Yeah, I think that's more what it's like now. Yeah.
Which is taken away. The thing it's taken away is like with DVDs, like we were saying on Amazon, you had to submit your DVD. Someone's shipping it, but it was always Tuesdays and it was always on Amazon and you kind of knew. But now with streaming, those dates and times don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
It was so easy to find these guys. And I remember back then when we were doing it, you had this influx of people who weren't even on Amazon and stuff, but I could do that thing and go to Amazon and I could find these guys. I could look at them, look them up online and then like send them an email and say, hey, we want to talk about this. And there was such demand for it. It was crazy.
Yeah. I remember when we like, before we would watch those, we would save the pile and we were like, talk about the craziest sounding ones. We're like, save this one. Don't watch this one yet. Save this one. And then we would save them the stack. And so they would watch like all like the weirdest sounding ones and then save those up for watching them all like when we were drinking beer. But that was great. But
yeah. No, it's it and I don't know. I mean, you talk about the 10
like
years.
Like a present, you know. You get like a present, like when you're treasure hunting for a movie. It's like when you used to find them in the video store. Yeah.
I probably have them. I probably have a box of them still sitting around somewhere. But because I think that model is kind of, because that is like, people would do a DVD. And I remember getting them just still like, it was like a CD case, like a plastic CD case. It was like, here's my DVD. It wasn't even in a DVD thing. But it used to just be, it's like, hey, print off 100 DVDs and mail them out to everyone and let's see what happens. That doesn't happen anymore because they're selling links. It's way harder now. And when the DVD thing kind of went away, there was this total lull. And that's kind of actually, to be honest, around 2013 when we kind of stopped, it was because there was this big shift in the industry. And I remember a couple of projects. We actually got to a point where there was a couple of projects that we had, but when the DVD market fell apart, all of a sudden almost indie film fell apart for a while because it just, the whole market disappeared. But it's changed now because streaming's back and there's actually even more demand. But I still don't think people have properly figured out this bottom up thing. Like that demand, that's why Dead Harvey still has a place. And what we were talking about is like, it's great if one of these things sneaks through the goalie and all of a sudden say, like, hey, everyone talks about how like Host or one of these big ones came back. But the fact that there's 10,000 micro films out there for every one that makes it through and no one's really looking at these. We were always like, well, someone should be looking at these because there's some fucking gems out there.
And so, studios are going to be making lower budget stuff, but not anywhere near the rate, because with the Hollywood system completely falling apart right now and just in shambles, they're going to be making lower budget stuff because they can't afford the blockbuster style $200 million movies like they used to, but it's still going to be nowhere near micro cinema movies.
I also think that though, but there's going to be more and more, I don't want to say demand, but because of the shift to digital and the shift to platforms and the shift to algorithms, what happens is like my Netflix looks different, even though you and I watch the same type of shit, my Netflix is going to look different than yours just because we have slightly different viewing habits. And I'm going to get served different content. So what's going to end up happening is there's going to be more niche stuff. Like the idea of, like we've all heard it, like when we were in film school, it's like MASH. How many people watch the finale of MASH? Well, why MASH was a hit was because it was what they call a four quadrant hit, right? Like it's like, it hit everybody. The whole audience could watch it. Well, that type of shit doesn't fly anymore. Like there's certain stuff. And if you can hit something that's like a Marvel movie that has such appeal to such a huge audience, that's great. But realistically, if you can do a lower budget movie and cater to a little tiny niche, those niches are going to percolate up. There is demand for, like, I remember when I first found out about like French New Wave horror. And all of a sudden it's like, then all of a sudden I found this little vein and I'm like, how do I find more of this? Well, now some algorithm or some platform is going to be like, oh, you like French New Wave horror? It's like, here's a bunch of other shit you're going to like.
Yeah.
And then those really niche movies, whether they're micro or indie, are going to percolate to that person because that's he's the right person for it. So I think the opportunity for all of this is, it's still not there. We're not even there yet to really...
Yeah.
Like there's going to be more of an audience for this. And I think every indie horror filmmaker out there, it's like, hey, great. Yeah, the one you went out there and spent $5,000 on your feature film. Okay, let's not expect that we're making the next Iron Man here. But the idea that it's going to find an audience and propel your career is very possible. And not only very possible, I think we're going to get to a point where that is what's going to happen. Like if you do the right film, like you're talking about Uncle Pecora. So talking about some of the favorites that we had, and we can talk about the one that you brought up as one of your favorites, and the title alone is going to make me stop, which was Bloodsucking Brides from Burbank.
Oh yes. Bloodsucking. I saw the t-shirt. Let's see. Okay. Oh, Bloodsucking Babes from Burbank.
Bloodsucking Babes from Burbank.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the ones that's like when we found out about these films and we go talk to these guys, it's like it's the title alone. You know what you're getting with it, right? Yeah. You know what you're getting with it. And you would see it. And the other one I was talking about, we don't have to talk about him, but the other one is I remember when we chatted with the guy who did Beach Party at the Threshold of Hell.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, they're just good titles. It's the same as Uncle Peckerhead. It's like, if I'm scrolling through shit and I find Bloodsucking Babes from Burbank or or Beach Party at the Threshold of Hell. Yeah, I'm going to stop and I'm going to check that out because that's talking to me.
Yeah.
And but anyhow, blood sucking babes from Burbank. You had the pleasure of talking to those guys. So that was, but now we'll talk about some of our favorite moments in Dead Harvey and some of the films and shit that we uncovered. So on to you for blood sucking babes.
Oh, so blood sucking babes is kind of funny because like, well, no, a lot of the filmmakers I would just like go buy them a beer and then we'd hang out and like BS for a while, talk about their movie and talk about other movies that we liked or whatnot. And so we went to this bar called the, what was it? It was the place where they shot Memento in Burbank. It was called the Blue Room. It may be called something different now, but yeah, and I found out they would usually close the streets down and shoot stuff there. You'd recognize it afterwards, but it was always dead in the middle of the day. So we went out in the patio and we were talking about that movie there. And it was, the title was like amusing to me. And this guy was like a very grassroots filmmaker. It was very entertaining. And then he was like, oh, it's going to cast you in this next movie that I'm doing. And so that was, and then he gave me the t-shirt. A lot of times the filmmakers would give you their t-shirts. Now we had another one where we went to that same bar and we talked to and we hung out with Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, I'm still friends with, I haven't obviously reached out. I'm still friends with him today, but that was Stump the Band.
Yeah.
And so I can't remember. They probably reached out to us and it was an indie horror about I can't even remember. Stump the Band. It was definitely a gory indie horror. But you and I showed up at the same bar, and all of a sudden we're looking at this guy and we're like, "This guy looks familiar. We know this guy." And it was Cousin Oliver. His name is Robbie Wrist. His name is Robbie Wrist.
Yeah.
And he's had two famous roles. He was He was Cousin Oliver from Brady Bunch. But then he was also the voice of Michelangelo on the cartoon series for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And so like when we figured that out, we're like, well, this is fucking crazy. We're sitting here in the Blue Room having beers with Cousin Oliver. But we were there because the two of them had decided, I think they even decided to make their own production company, and they were going to get into kind of indie horror. And if you go on IMDb, it's still the only film that they've done together. But it was, I mean, we sat down and had quite a few beers with those guys. And that was another one that was quite funny.
The funny thing is, too, is that the other, I can't remember whether they co-directed that movie or not, but the other guy that was there, he ended up, before we interviewed him, he just like showed up in my apartment. And there's a knock on the door. I'm like, who is this? And then he goes, I made Stump the Band, and I just wanted to see like what the people that review these movies look like, and I want to see where they live. And I'm like, take a look. It'll take 3
Yeah. Come on in. Come on in. Take a look.
That was kind of fun. I remember one time, like, I went to this. That reminds me. I went to this. This was, like, frowned upon. But I thought it was funny. But this was frowned upon for me to do. But I went to this it was sort of like the script lunch thing in Santa Monica. And you basically pay for the option to go like listen to some, you can listen to this guy give a presentation about pitches. Everybody has lunch. And then you pitch your idea to somebody that's like sitting in there that's done something. So this guy had written a book called Hollywood 101, and he was taking everybody's pitches. And so I pitched him this movie. It's called like In His Image. And it was about a father that tries to mold his son, a father that's a serial killer that tries to mold his son into his own image. And so the guy was like, that's a high concept. You should bring that over to my office. So his assistant called me like a couple of days later, and I was all excited about it. I brought it over, and I decided to bring it over in person, which is not a good idea. And Deborah Hill was there, and she was a lady that produces the Halloween movies with John Carpenter. And she was there like with her dog and everything, just like hanging out at her home. And I brought it over to her house. And I was like, oh, I just thought I'd bring this over in person. You know, tell her to bring it out. She goes, no, thanks. I was just like, oh, shit, I shouldn't have done that. there's a certain, like, with the low budgetness, I don't think it's a big deal at all. But on the other level, dropping stuff off, always mail stuff in. Don't. Or emailed it now.
No, fuck. I would have dropped it off. I would have dropped it off.
Yeah, I did not get a very good look. I got an evil eye from her.
Whatever. Whatever. So I think, I mean, while we were doing the Dead Harvey, that was really, I mean, that was the best part about it was mm-hmm. that we were talking with guys. Like, you would sit there, we'd go up beers, we'd end up going to these different bars. You'd meet with Robbie Rist, mm-hmm. you'd meet the guy from Bloodsucking Babes. And the other one that resonates with me, because I thought it was so ahead of its time, and it turns out it was when we met the Feudio guys.
Yeah.
So I think, again, I have no idea if they reached out to us or we reached out to them, but like, this is what we did. Like, people were like, we were kind of like the only guys doing indie horror. They were way ahead of their time for sure. Because what they were doing is they were doing 2 to 3 minute short horror videos and posting on YouTube. And they had one that went viral. And the guy that directed the one that went viral is a guy named Drew Daywalt. And we ended up befriending him quite a bit because we talked about a whole pile of projects that he was doing, and he's actually gone on to do some pretty cool stuff. I think he's actually gone into like children's books. Like, I noticed on a Star Wars book that Drew Daywalt was he had written something about BB-8. So like, even recently he's doing his own shit.
He did this movie called The Day of the Crayon, or this book, the children's book called The Day of the
Crayon. Yeah, that's
what, really big. And I think he's done some other stuff like that. But he did a movie with Sean William Scott before he started doing some horror stuff or getting together with Feudio, I think. And
that was after.
Okay.
Because he also did the unofficial Leprechaun sequel.
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that was all after we had met
Billy Zane was in that too, I believe.
Yeah. I don't think it was called Leprechaun. It was like, it was meant to be Leprechaun 3 or 4.
Yeah.
But they ended up calling it like Shamrock or something. Like, I can't remember what they called it, but it was like, it was they like completely changed the
origin story.
Yeah. And we ended up, I remember going down to LA and meeting him for a coffee. Mm-hmm. And we chatted about that. It was when he was doing that, mm-hmm. the unofficial Leprechaun. It was the official unofficial Leprechaun sequel.
Yeah.
And, but he literally, I don't want to say blew up, but he had one, they probably posted like 10, 20 different mm-hmm. horror shorts, but he had one that literally got ripped off and went completely viral. And it was, people would even know it because it actually got ripped off numerous times. Like it was the person going to bed, and then they panned down to the bottom, and there was like a demon underneath the mm-hmm. bed or something like that. And it got ripped off numerous times. And it kind of blew him up because all of a sudden there was this 3 minute or 2 minute horror short that had like a million views on YouTube, and it probably has millions of views today. But he kind of escalated from there. I don't know. Feudio, I still see them on social media that they're doing something. I don't think they're doing much, but they still kind of post it around. But those were definitely all it was really cool. Like, it was cool to see back then when we used to chat with these guys, and mm-hmm. some of them were doing horror shorts. Some of them were doing like an indie film. Some of them were screenwriting. Some of them were doing whatever, but it really did feel like a community once they got to know what we were kind of trying to do. And people tried to, like, they'd cast it. Oh, let's talk about this. Like, we built lots of relationships. Like one guy who had done Scary or Die, mm-hmm. when he had made Scary or Die, mm-hmm. and
clown horror anthology. Well, the clown was part of it.
It was an anthology. It was an anthology. But like, when he released that, he had done a film before. He had done a feature before. He was like a character actor, had done a bunch of ads and stuff like that. But he loved horror. Did one horror. Then we worked with him on Scary or Die. And we built relationships. I did an Indiegogo campaign with him for another film that failed. We had done piles of like we built a lot of relationships with these guys, and it was pretty cool. I really actually think that I don't even know why we ended up stopping about 2013, but it seemed like a lot of the market had fallen out mm-hmm. because of DVDs. I remember that was a big thing, that like the DVDs, like you could make a DVD, make your money back with just a bit of promotion. And when that DVD market kind of fell, it kind of like took the air out of a lot of indie film. But I also, that's also why I'm pretty excited about now, because I feel like it's all kind of changing and it's coming back. And now there's even more demand now, but people are still figuring it out. That's what I want to help with, what we're doing. Like, I want to work with these producers and indie filmmakers and writers, Because this is a whole new world, and I don't think we figured it out yet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was around the time, 2013 was around the time that I really noticed a lot of people moving out of LA. Mm-hmm. Whether it be just like friends I had or other indie filmmakers that I know and whatnot. But now everything has completely changed where it doesn't matter where you live. You can make a movie wherever you live, indie horror or otherwise, and have just as good of a chance as if you're in, I mean, nothing's even open in LA right now anyway. So it doesn't really, I mean, most of the productions that are there have moved out of there and they're shooting in other areas like Louisiana or Canada or North Carolina. You know, they started shooting some stuff. What's another area for it as well too?
San Antonio's a big one now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the thing. It's very decentralized now. I think there's a lot. I mean, this is why I'm excited for us to launch this again.
Yeah.
And is that there's more opportunity now than there was then. And it's really, we're just at the real start of it right now.
And
you don't have to be in LA. Like you said, you don't have
to be. That's right. And I think like, especially for indie movies, there's more of I really like the kind of the feel or the atmosphere of watching a movie that's made from a different region than I haven't seen a movie being made for a while. Like watching a horror movie that's made in Kansas has a completely different feel than a horror movie that's made in LA. But I like to see like all those different kinds of horror movies made in different areas throughout the states or outside of the states as well too, in other countries. But that to me is just cool. You can make a movie anywhere. And I think any horror is perfect for that. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are. For very, very little money, you can make your own indie horror movie.
Yeah, and that is something now that exists now that didn't exist 10 years ago, too.
Definitely.
Is that you can legitimately make something that doesn't look that bad for about $5,000 or less, even. Like 10 years ago when we would go out, we were literally shooting on camcorders and stuff, and the lighting and the cameras looked like garbage. But now, like, it's not that hard to make something that looks good. So I mean, the barrier for entry is low, and I think also the ability to get it out there and talk about it and find an audience is there. It's just no one's really figured that out yet. It's an exciting time for indie film. Like I said, I don't like a lot of other podcasts and a lot of other stuff that I'm reading and listening to talk about the real technical issues of it. Like I'm not interested in it. I mean, I'm interested in it because I'm interested in the process of filmmaking.
Yeah.
But like the idea of saying, I got an idea and I could put that idea onto something, create it, and then now what do I do? And be able to do that in almost an affordable way. And have the tools and resources that are out there right now is kind of why we're doing this again.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about like several of the people, including like the Fudio guys, they sort of stand out to me because they were making movies every weekend. So there's the guys, the Duplass brothers, Mark and Jay Duplass, that do all those indie movies. They would always talk about how they would just go out and shoot movies every weekend. And they ended up doing a lot of features. They would shoot a feature, you know, in a couple weekends, that short of amount of time. You know, Roger Corman used to shoot movies in 5 days. I think Little Shop of Horrors was shot in about 5 days. But right around that time frame, these movies were also kind of like mostly talking, and they would sort of make stuff up when they were doing these features. But these guys would make, the Fudio guys would make these horror shorts, and just they were out there every weekend shooting stuff.
Yeah,
just putting the work in, and that to me is kind of it's really admirable, and then it shows that they have a lot of passion for what they're doing, and I think that they're going to get where they're going a lot faster than most people because they're just willing to put that extra work in. It's so much easier to just procrastinate and not go out and make anything, even if it doesn't get distributed or whatnot. You know.
Yeah. No. We live in a time now where you just crank stuff out like. There's no reason not to go out there and kind of make it. I mean, on the other side, the issue is like I was delving in, and we could talk about it on a future one more, into the screenwriting stuff. Screenwriting takes time. There are guys that crank scripts out, but you know, but also you don't have to. I was the guy who made Headhunter, who's the same guy who did Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. That script was formatted properly, but it was only 30 pages because there was so little dialogue in it, right? If you know where you're filming and you know what it is, like you can hammer out a script pretty easily. Like you can hammer out stuff. I think you're right. I mean, it's content makers should be making content, and now it's about finding the audiences for it. So I mean, that's where Dead Harvey started with a blog, and actually Dead Harvey's still out there. It's all the content. One day we should actually pull all that content off and store it somewhere, just because there's interviews with hundreds of filmmakers on there.
And the people that we talked to, they had some pretty cool, like, ahead of their time ideas for marketing as well, too. So the Beach Party, The Threshold of Hell, that guy that you were talking about, now that movie is sort of like a Beach Party movie meets a Mad Max movie. And that guy, I remember, like, when we talked to him, we interviewed him at a tiki bar, and he brought over, he was already trying to market his movie with all these other means. So he brought over this big, like, oversized one-shot comic book for it, this sort of condense the story into it. And I thought that was a really cool idea for him to do at the time to promote his indie movie. But there's some of the guys that had some really cool ideas for that. But that's some of the things that we plan to include here, are ideas for marketing your movies as well, too.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately it's build a community. Let's find an audience and figure out the ways to get these projects out there. And I think, like, even all the way at the beginning, talking about Uncle Peckerhead, just from the title choice to how you shoot it, to how you, what it's titled, what, like what your poster looks like, what other stuff you're putting out there with, is all going to find it. But I think we're just at the beginning. So all filmmakers out there, I mean, Brad and I started this journey. Well, really, it started in film school, but like when we originally launched Dead Harvey, you know, took a break for a while, but now, you know, we're back because I think there's an opportunity here, and I want to work with these filmmakers again. I think there's a bigger opportunity now to take independent film and micro film, genre film, and these fun movies that need to find an audience and help them find an audience. Because I think the same thing that we found 10 years ago or 13 years ago when we launched Dead Harvey is back again now, that there's this appetite for it. I think there's more content now than ever. And that's probably a good place to end the podcast today. And now plowing forward, we're going to keep telling stories. And then hopefully eventually, you know, we want to talk to other filmmakers and talk about their stories. But next week, we're going to talk about a certain manager that we had built a relationship with. It was because we had Dead Harvey and a bunch of people kind of knew who we were, and we were also writing a bunch of scripts. We got a bit of notoriety around one. We had an idea that we took out. This guy met with us. We probably had a relationship for about a year, but we'll talk about our intoxicated encounters with this manager and what we found out about who managers are and what managers do. That's what we'll talk about next week. And I think also for our picks of the week next week, we're gonna do a theme, because there's two movies. We're gonna talk about time travel movies.
Yeah.
Because there's two indie films that are worth watching. We talked about it before, which one we want to talk about. One is Time Crimes, which I think is one of the better, like, honestly, if you're talking about time travel movies, it's in the top two or three. Time Cop, number one.
Yes.
Time Crimes, somewhere below that. And then Triangle. Triangle is a slow burn at the beginning, and then once it gets going and you figure out what's going on, it's a fantastic movie. So anyway, we're going to talk about Time Crimes and Triangle next week as our picks of the week. To conclude it all, look, that's the whole point of this. We're trying to build a community. We want to work with filmmakers. We want to work with producers and filmmakers and people who are into this content. And realistically, we want to work together and make you succeed. I came from indie film. I came from filmmaking. I now run a marketing company, so I can see this sort of view as a whole. And I think there's an opportunity to mesh this all together. So I think if people do subscribe and follow and reach out to us, we want to talk to you, and we want to see if we can kind of move the needle and make things happen. Because I do think there's a big opportunity for indie film, especially indie genre films. So please keep following, and let's make some stuff happen.